case for argument is Stevo versus Fraser. Mr. Radzilowski.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Radzilowski. With me is Mr. Stevo, who is the appellant, and Greg Kroger, who works for me and helped prepare the brief. In this particular case, when we were doing the jurisdictional statement, we were asked, I think, a fairly telling question about whether there was jurisdiction for the magistrate who heard the case. And after doing our research and looking at the record, we discovered there was not that jurisdiction. We put that in an amended jurisdictional statement. I think the appellees, in their response on page 5 of their brief, agreed in total with our jurisdictional statement. And I think, I think this court, Judge Posner, you wrote a decision, Mark 1, Inc. versus Grubber, in which you did point out that without the acceptance of jurisdiction by both sides, there's no jurisdiction for a magistrate to hear the case or to issue a decision.
What exactly happened when this case was transferred to Magistrate Judge Finnegan?
What happened was we just received a note that there was a reassignment of the case to Magistrate Finnegan. I mean, it was like she was a new magistrate, and each of the magistrates got to assign a few cases to her. And I don't think there was anything anybody said or did. I mean, she got the case and scheduled the hearing. I have to say that I probably was not aware of the strict rules that they have with regard to consenting to a particular magistrate at that time.
But look, your consent says both parties voluntarily consent to have a United States magistrate judge conduct any and all further proceedings. Should this case be reassigned to a magistrate judge other than the magistrate judge designated, the undersigned may object within 30 days of such reassignment. If an objection is filed by any party, the case will be reassigned to the district judge. So what's the problem?
Okay, that particular item is not a matter of the record.
It's right here in my hand. I don't understand.
Do we need to fix the record?
Well, I mean, it was not. I went through.
Whether it's in the record.
What?
What difference does it make?
Well,
here it is. You know, you signed it.
Well, I mean, the first time I saw this document was over the weekend.
The first sign you saw. Who cares when you first saw it? It's a very broad consent, right?
And it was never signed by my client.
Well, it was signed by his counsel, and that's enough.
It was signed in 2000.
Was it filed in the district court?
To my knowledge, no. This document, what happened was, and I did some research over the weekend, there is document number 37, which is a two-page document filed on 10-16 of 08. That was in the record. It says it's a two-page document, and it was an assignment to Judge Keys. And the second page of the document says does indicate that there's an attachment, but what was filed with the court was a two-page document. I was not aware of the existence of this other page, and if you read the page itself, it says, file this consent only if all parties have consented on this form to the exercise of jurisdictions by a United States magistrate judge. This document that was signed that you have in your hands was never made part of the court record. And I don't know how.
Signed by all the parties?
I have no way of knowing who it was signed by or why it was not filed with the court.
Well, it's kind of weird because it says name of parties, the other party, Pamela Fraser et al. That's not exactly the names.
Yeah. And it is
but
not.
It's signed, not by her, but by a lawyer.
This was something that was sent, if you look at the fax number, was sent by my opposing counsel
okay,
to the clerk
so
of the court.
All right, you're not relying on this. It wasn't filed. Okay, no jurisdiction.
I don't know how I came into the case later. How am I supposed, if the document was never filed with the court, how does it become part of the court record at the very last minute? How does it become part of, you know, my client? When I asked him about it, I sent him a copy of it when I got it on Saturday. Sunday, he tells me he has no memory of ever making this consent. So I did a little bit of further research, and there's a couple of additional cases, Mark 1 versus Grubber, in which I think you wrote the opinion, in which you talk about something has to be unequivocal, it has to be filed with the court, and you have to have, and it has to be a consent by the party. It can't, I don't think that a consent by the party's attorney to a broad thing, and how am I supposed to, like,
Have we said you've got to have party signatures before on magistrate consents? That would be, if magistrate's jurisdiction depend on having party signatures, okay. Wouldn't that be a pretty dramatic change?
Let me change slightly what I'm saying. Is this particular document, which was not part of the record, was not something that I could, that I would have had a chance to look at and follow. I mean, how am I supposed to follow a document that is not part of the record and that I'm not aware of?
All right, I understand. You're saying what? All right, let's have enough of this.
Right.
You're saying it wasn't filed. It may be imperfect because of the et al. Or because of the signature by the lawyer or so on. But in any event, it wasn't filed, and so it's not effective. That's your argument.
That's correct. And I also say if you look at the specific document.
Details.
So that's
the end of the case, right? No jurisdiction.
If you accept my argument, that's the end of the case.
What is
with
your
regard to the merit, there are two other issues.
What does your opponent say?
The only thing that I have from the opponent is when I filed my jurisdictional statement in my brief, which I did after prompting by the clerk of the court's office saying you didn't answer the specific issue, which I try to answer the best of my recollection. He, on page 5 of his brief, says, I agree completely with your jurisdictional statement.
Both of you agree there's no jurisdiction because there was no filed consent to a transfer to another magistrate. Is that correct?
That's what the record evidence is.
Is that correct? Is that your position? Where's the opponent? Oh, sorry.
To page 5.
Judge, first of all, our agreement with the jurisdictional statement was agreeing with the jurisdictional statement set forth in the first brief filed by the appellant, the first brief filed in the case. His statement on page 1 is, the United States District Court of the Northern District of Illinois had jurisdiction of this cause with 28 U.S.C. 1331 of the sanctions brought pursuant to 42 U.S.C. 1983 to redress the deprivation of the color of law of plaintiff's appellee's rights as secured by the United States Constitution. District Court granted summary judgment in favor of defendant appellees on January 3rd, 2011. Entry of summary judgment was a final judgment, and plaintiff appellant filed timely notice of appeal on February 2nd, 2011. Therefore, the court is Judge, that was the jurisdictional statement we were agreeing to in our brief. Other than that, I believe that this court has jurisdiction, as my argument will set forth the district court and the magistrate.
Mr. Radzilowski, let me ask you, at least let me. My take on this jurisdictional problem is we've got consents in the record, okay? We've got them from the document, from the Rule 26 statement filed on October 1st saying the parties unanimously consent to proceed before the magistrate judge at this time, okay? So we've got consent to a magistrate. Under the Roll case, which postdated the Kalin case that you're talking about, essentially, then the question becomes, was there implied consent to proceed before Magistrate Judge Finnegan? We've clearly got that in terms of the conduct by never raising the issue. And that's that can be taken under roll as long as the parties had notice of their ability to object to the reassignment.
That's correct.
Well, even if it's not in the record yet, or if it needs to be added to the record, the unfiled document shows very clearly that counsel for both parties were on notice of a right to object if there was a reassignment. And if that's correct, then we've got jurisdiction, and we ought to just decide the merits of the appeal.
I have 2 points to raise that. First of all, if there's a document that's not part of the record, I was not a signatory to that document. I have no access to it. And so how was I apprised that that was
your successor counsel?
Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's not part of the record, if it's not filed with the court, how am I apprised that that was what my client's rights were and what was set forth? The second thing is, in response to his statement, we filed our amended brief long before he filed his brief. I mean, so for him to say, I was responding to your first brief and not your second brief, I think it's disingenuous.
Well, nobody's disputing whether the party, nobody's claiming the parties consented in writing to final judgment by Judge Finnegan.
Okay.
The argument is consent by conduct.
All right.
So I don't see an inconsistency there.
Well, let's move on to the merits. Actually, your time
With regard to the merits, we have two arguments. One is that we were not able to successfully attack the motion for summary judgment because our efforts to get discovery on the point about the circumstances, the approximately 250 other people who hadn't had meters, we were not allowed. We made 3 different requests for that discovery, and I think it was an abuse of a discretion for the judge to deny it. The second point, and I think it's another basic point, is this court has always required strict compliance.
No, we have always allowed district judges discretion in deciding how strictly to enforce their local rules.
Well, I mean, but there is, I mean, you can go from strict to substantial, but there was no compliance with the short numbered paragraph response. I mean, there was no way for me to respond to short numbered paragraphs that don't exist. And I have represented on appeal several pro se plaintiffs.
Your problem is the numbers, right?
Well,
you could have numbered them.
They're not like one fact per paragraph.
You could have numbered them and say I'm responded. Anyway, well, we'll have to hear from the other.
Okay, I appreciate your opportunity to speak. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Radzielowski. Mr. Murphy?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Peter Murphy. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellees Pam Frazier et al. And the City of Blue Island. To go ahead and jump right to the first issue we discussed here, which was the assignment to Judge Finnegan ultimately of this case. Local Rule 73.1b provides for reassignment to a magistrate judge following consent by all parties. As the courts rightly pointed out, on October 2nd of 08, then counsel for plaintiff Mr. Stevo, whose name at the time was Attorney Philip Block, signed a consent to have a magistrate conduct any and all further proceedings, including trial and entry of final judgment. Now, the circumstances of why this consent isn't in the court file are beyond my recollection from 2008. I recall signing it. I recall Mr. Block signing it. My best recollection, it was probably presented during a routine status or hearing date. That it's not in the file is, again, beyond my specific memory to recall. What happened recently, on September 9th, I got a call from the clerk of this court, Mr. Sylvester Kuziora, I apologize if that's a mispronunciation, who said that there was an appended document to, again, the one we've referred to as the order by the court, which transferred the case. The appended document was this consent. The consent did appear in my files. At that point, I scanned it as requested by the clerk. I sent a copy of it on September 9th to the clerk of this court and copied Mr. Radzielowski via email a copy of that very statement. Other than that, the case was assigned, of course, to Magistrate Keyes back in October of 08. It remained in his on his call through approximately October 26th of 2010. Then newly appointed Magistrate Judge Finnegan was assigned the case pursuant to internal operating procedure.
Okay, we know that.
Okay, yeah. Yes, and then it proceeded on through motion for summary judgment. Again, prior to this appeal, no party objected to or questioned reassignment of this case to Magistrate Judge Finnegan, and she ultimately entered judgment for the defendants in the district court. Unless there's any questions on that issue, I can proceed to the other issues raised on appeal.
Do you have anything on the merits you want to
Yes, say? Judge, a couple of quick issues. Regarding the discovery requests, this court, as this court is aware, discovery requests, rather discovery rulings by the district court are reviewed for abuse of discretion. There is a mechanism by which, if there's a pending motion for summary judgment, a party wishes to take another deposition. That mechanism is to go ahead and request a postponement of the summary judgment ruling and use depositions as support, rather to take depositions. This should be supported by affidavit, as this court decided in 2000 in Wood v. City of Chicago. I will point out that approximately 1 week before any deadlines in responding to motions for summary judgment, we did have an impromptu call from Judge Finnegan. She had both parties on the telephone at that point and specifically requested of counsel whether he had any other additional evidence to present for the motion for summary judgment. At that point, he wanted another week. No other evidence was presented, and the judge ultimately ruled. There were numerous discovery conducted in this case, written discovery. There were depositions taken, three depositions of defendants herein, as well as the deposition of the plaintiff himself. The city of Blue Island shut the spigot off of Mr. Stevo's water because he was not cooperating for a year.
No, we know the facts.
I understand. Yeah. I was going to make an analogy about the spigot of discovery, but I'll skip that. Pursuant to Local Rule then 56.1, all motions for summary judgment are reviewed on appeal de novo. But a district court's compliance with local rule, as I know was mentioned by the court, is it's reviewed on abuse of discretion standard. In fact, this court, I think, specifically said that considerable deference is given to a judge's interpretation of their own rules in the district court. That's the Waldridge versus American Hawks standard. This court decided that case in 1994. The city would simply state no harm, no foul with respect to the local 56.1. Alleged violation. We do concede that there were not numbered paragraphs. However, if we assume that the numbering of these paragraphs is a local rules requirement to avoid confusion in drafting responses, a review of the record shows that Mr. Stevo was able to file both a memorandum in opposition to the summary judgment motion and a SIR reply. In each of these, he was able to clearly set forth the facts that he disputed without confusion. And further, in its memorandum opinion and order, the district court considered and addressed each fact raised by the defense, which Mr. Stevo contested. Therefore, no prejudice exists due to the
counsel,
technical
procedure
violation.
Procedure aside, what do you understand the
pardon?
Setting aside the procedure, do you understand this constitutional claim?
Yes, it's a due process clause claim. He's stating under that as a result of the fact that he was given not sufficient notice and opportunity to be heard, his water was shut off. That's what you're referring to, Your Honor?
Well, I have a little difficulty with the merits here.
I see.
Trying to fit this water shutoff,
mm-hmm.
which occurred after many, many notices,
yes.
into some sort of a constitutional
theory. I understand that, Judge. I think that the standard of review for a water shutoff case, it's not the same as a due process clause for other types of rights. And, of course, we understand that. I don't understand, then, why after all these numerous notices, including one posted on his house, he's allowed to come in, not allowed, rather, but his case can survive a district court challenge. I have to agree with the court that he was given beyond, I think, the minimum standards of due process notice and opportunity, and his water was shut off as a result of his noncompliance. Unless there's any other questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Murphy. So, Mr. Radzilowski, we'll give you a minute if you have anything you'd like to respond to.
Very briefly, that we have both an equal protection claim, which said that he, you know, he was entitled to the same equal protection other people. And the reason we don't have any evidence is that my efforts to try to get discovery on the issue, and there's admittedly 250 other people who didn't have the meters. That's why we couldn't get to that. With regard to the equal protection claim, part of that claim was the fact that the ordinance itself did not provide for a penalty for not complying with the shutoff requirement. It had a penalty if you didn't pay your water bill, but there's no question his water bill was paid. And what they did is they told him on the 17th that if you don't have this thing done by the 27th, we are going to shut off your water. and there was like nothing in the ordinance provided for that. There was testimony on his part that he tried to talk to the city and ask for more time, and there's a dispute whether that happened. But that's the gist of the claim. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both counsel. And court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.